Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy, how are you?
I'm very well.
I think this is rather apt having Jamie Cullum on today for a couple of reasons. One, obviously he's got this Christmas album out, which is an original sounding Christmas album.
It's an original album with beautiful Nelson Riddle type arrangements.
But all new songs, right?
Yeah.
All written by him.
Which actually makes it a genuinely interesting piece of work.
Rather than your Michael Bublé kind of like, let's, you know, that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But also, given that this is, you know, Stephen Sondheim has just died, left us, it's apt having him on because this is a guy who's delved into the American songbook really successfully over the years, but also covered Sondheim in his career.
Yeah, well, he's covered all sorts, but he hasn't just sort of regurgitated. It's been a very, very interesting sort of take on it. I mean, like his Sondheim is almost sort of trip hop. It's really good.
So we thought that we would definitely talk about music at Christmas because this is where we are in the season. And I want to know what sort of records went on in your house, Guy, over that period. What did you get for the under your Christmas
That's
tree?
That's a good point. I can't remember anything Christmassy musically.
No, but you know, there were albums that came out. I'm going to tell you mine in a minute when Jamie comes on because we'll ask him. But you know, what was the album under your Christmas tree that your parents might have bought you?
Oh, I see. Oh, it would be something that I asked them. Yeah. I asked them It was more the other way around. It was more that I used to buy my mum albums that I wanted. And so I remember I bought her Rough Mix by Pete Townsend and Ronnie Lane. It's saying, yeah, you'll love this, mum. It's right up your street.
Mum, here's Gentle Giant.
What's yours then? What's yours?
But let's have a chat with Jamie about Sondheim, about Christmas, about his new album, and about his career.
Yeah. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. I it's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
How are you doing?
Good. There you are.
There I am.
Wow, look at you.
Does it look... do you know, it looks posh by accident because my laptop died. I thought I can't do it on my phone. So I plugged in a posh camera into my studio computer that I record on. And so it looks all fancy.
That is a super camera.
That is so posh. That is like an 8 camera zoom.
But it's a long lens, isn't it? I mean,
it's a long lens. We use it for filming stuff here in the studio. And I quickly Googled how to, cause I thought, well, you know, it's nice to be able to see each other's faces, isn't it? So, I hooked it up to a computer, downloaded some software, looked through it, and I'm like, oh, that looks pretty nice, isn't it?
Oh, mate.
I think we need to negotiate the release terms for this, frankly.
I'm very, very inexpensive.
Which part of the room is Stephen Sondheim sitting in? did I say Stephen Sondheim? Well, I met Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
Oh,
he's upset. We're on a bit of a Sondheim tip here because obviously we're gutted.
Yes, yeah, we mentioned him earlier, and sorry, that's why I flipped into that because obviously you covered Stephen. This is Stephen has just died, and we wondered if you know what your thoughts were on this great man.
Well, I think one of the true modern greats. There's no side to that, is there? Because I think when someone produces that amount of work consistently over the years of such a huge amount of quality, they surely have got to go into the realms of being like a kind of a Mozart or a Beethoven or a you know, a great kind of classic composer. And I don't even mean in the musical sense, because actually a lot of the music was far from classic, you know, and I think massively respected by everyone who worked with them. There's no one saying a bad word about it. I know people don't tend to, well, I mean, people do when someone passes on, don't they? But
I can't wait.
I keep discovering things of his that I haven't picked apart. And, you know, that song, the Giant song from Into the Woods, I'd never listened to properly before.
Oh,
and
again,
they're just individual gems in huge gem palaces. It's, yeah, amazing.
I went to a masterclass of his in the 90s. Gary and I were writing a musical together. Yeah. And and it was extraordinary. It was at the Royal Academy. And all these students had to get up and they'd do a song. And then he was with him sitting there. And then he'd say to them, okay, what do you think it's about? And they go, oh, well, I think it's about this. And every time, he'd just go, no, that's not it at all. Mm. And it was a bit unfair. It's almost like he was so clever.
Yeah.
He could just do what he wanted. And he would just turn around the meaning of these songs. And half-time, I think he was just making it up on the spot just because he could.
Yeah.
But it was just a level of genius and understanding of his own
stuff.
So
did you guys finish this musical?
We did.
One got
put on at by the National Theatre sort of youth.
And it's still performed.
It's called Bedbug.
What's that?
Bedbug. It was an adaptation of Mayakovsky. He wrote a play called Bedbug when the music was done by Shostakovich originally.
Mm.
And we adapted it with a guy called Snu Wilson, a playwright called Snu Wilson, no longer with us.
Yeah.
And it gets done by the Youth Theatre every now and again. And we popped along to, in fact, the very first time it was done at the National was exactly 17 and a half years ago when my wife went into labour that night with our first child.
That's
and I
right.
said, we're not going to the hospital until this is finished and I've been up on stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. Has she forgiven you for that?
Yeah, but my boy, that boy who was born that night is an incredible pianist, incredible.
Oh,
and
there you
he's going to go off to university to do music.
Brilliant. Oh, how cool.
Being Alive is my favourite Stephen Sondheim song.
Yeah,
lyrics are unbelievable.
Unbelievable, yeah. Everything about that song is... It's funny, isn't it? Because when you are a songwriter and you hear another song that you love, I don't know about you, but my first impulse is to listen to it, but I also want to learn it, because it's a bit like people who like taking apart cars, classic cars or something, or someone who loves electronics and they go, oh, let's take this apart. I love to do that. And then as soon as you start taking it apart, you feel even more, I feel even more insignificant, and I go, oh my God, this is even cleverer than I thought it was.
Yeah.
When you realize how the lyrics hit with the melody and the chords, and just how the chords are informing what the lyrics are in them. All that, he wrote these songs with such symmetry with their achievements. They were similarly high in their achievements with every aspect of it, and it's just kind of dazzling, really.
Yeah, don't you find though, when you try and deconstruct songs, like the songs that really get you, they're either much simpler or much more complicated than you actually think they
are. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I
always learn so much when I do it.
I don't think this is wrong for me to say, because I did hear this via a friend of his, but the night he passed away, he had a Thanksgiving party, and it was a dinner party, and all his guests left, and Stephen went to bed and never woke up.
Amazing.
But, brilliant. You know, perfect in a way, no. You know.
I had to lunch before he died, Leslie Bricus, because I covered one of his songs, If I Ruled the World. And actually, I did do Pure Imagination as well, but the version I was particularly proud of was If I Ruled the World. And it's amazing to chat to him. And he also had a long life. And by all accounts, I think something about songwriting and being engaged in something you're really passionate about can lead to quite a long, interesting life in some situations.
Anyway, let's talk about you, Jamie.
That's not as interesting.
I've got to say, you're one of the few people we've ever had on this show where I can say I've interviewed you before.
Go on. Where did that happen?
He forgot. He can't remember,
sorry.
Guy. He has no memory of it.
No, of course he doesn't. If he did, it would be weird.
Was I drunk?
No, I was.
Okay.
It was... It was backstage at the Brits in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And I had this little studio set up. It was for this, what was meant to be an online magazine thing. And you were absolutely charming.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah, there it is.
And I've met you.
I was utterly forgettable.
I've met Jamie a few times. And I bet he can remember me.
I can remember you. Most people who've met you can remember you, though.
It's an incredibly mature chat we're having, isn't it?
Listen, we got to talk about Christmas because we are actually almost at Christmas, or we're in the Christmas season.
In fact, yes, this should be the Jamie Cullum Christmas special rock on.
Brilliant. Thursday. I'll take it.
And this amazing record you've made of new Christmas songs, which is.
Thank
brilliant.
You.
With brilliant arrangements.
I must say,
fantastic. Because it's the sort of thing, this is something I want to talk to you about, is the thing, because I'm worried, the fact that you grew up with hip hop and all that, and then just sort of veered off to jazz, and then, you know, and from that, and then sort of came back to pop. But I love this idea of, because I have this fear that complicated music is vanishing. So I just love the fact that this can still happen. We can still have beautiful Count Basie type arrangements.
Yeah.
Well, it was the whole thing was it kind of came about in quite a surprising way, because like everyone, my touring got cancelled last year.
But why was that then?
Well, I had a cold. Yeah. We were 4 days into the tour. You know, I'm not saying that for any kind of, because I know everyone's got the same story, particularly in this business. But I kind of got home and I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I just released quite a long kind of personal originals album. And I thought about making a Christmas album for a while, but I didn't want to do the obvious thing for me to do would be do something a bit like what Michael Bublé's done, you know, with the big band and the classics and stuff. And I think he's obviously done that masterfully well.
Those chestnuts are pretty well roasted, aren't they?
Exactly. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that, because there's no it's not going to be better than that. And it's not, there's no, who needs, you know, he's done it. And what's the point? So I'd worked with Robbie a year before, and he'd done an album where he'd had the classics on one disc and the new ones on another. I thought, well, that's a good idea, I said. But my theory was I would have to only do originals if people were going to give the new ones any kind of chance. Because I think if you mix them up, then people skip to the ones they know. So I thought, if I'm going to give these songs a chance to fly, then I'm going to just get in the zone. I'm going to write songs, obviously about Christmas, but within this kind of Tin Pan Alley, Great American Songbook era of songwriting that I feel like at this stage I know really well. And I've written a lot of songs like that, and I love to write like that. I thought, well, let's just write a couple and see where it goes. And 2 became 10. And then I went to my label and said, I've written 10 original Christmas songs. They're like, oh, could you do some covers as well? I'm like, no, I'm not going to do any covers. I'm just going to do the originals. And I said, and by the way, no covers. And I want to do it in Abbey Road with a 65-piece orchestra. Is that okay? And they were like,
And, on Christmas,
you know,
Eve.
God bless them. Exactly. And we did. And, it, you know, my friend Tom Richards arranged all the music, who I've been working with for years. And we have the same reference points. We referenced records that we loved and arrangements that we loved. And made this album, The Piano Man at Christmas.
I noticed that, sorry, Gary, but because I've read all the notes on it, what's nice is that it's like for every song, you had a specific reference point that you started from. This, like,
yeah, exactly. So I think it was, you know, I really believe that you're inspired by stuff that you love. And I wrote a song called Beautiful Altogether, which was, you know, it was trying to write a song a bit like Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, kind of like a ballad, melancholic a Christmas song with some, hopefully some gorgeous harmony and gorgeous melodies, a kind of yearning song that takes you on a nice musical 2-5-1 journey. And so they all kind of had yin and yang kind of versions of them here.
So, but
those are chords he's referring to. This
yeah. When you
don't understand.
When you sat down to do this album, though, did you sort of jot down the different facets of what Christmas is about to you, to other people? I mean, obviously, it's not the same to everybody, especially at this time. You know, it can be pretty rough as well. Or did you take a bunch of Christmas songs you liked and sort of paralleled them up?
No, it was probably more, I was in a bit more of a flow state than that, and I could have done it like that, and there might have been another time where I would have done it like that. But knowing that I had 3 months to write these songs. And then I thought, well, if it's going to come out this year, but bear in mind, this is the pandemic year of last year. I thought, I'm going to have to write them all by June. And then we're going to have to record them in July. So I think we all have a lot of inbuilt knowledge about Christmas and Christmas music. I think literally everyone pretty much, you know, in the Western world does. And I just felt like if I focused on the melodies and some really good titles, I came up with good titles first, thought, well, I'm going to write a song that sounds a bit like this, and this is going to be the title. And then I just started playing around with it, and gradually the lyrics came through, and I wrote a few lyrics down, and then I just kind of went through it, kind of taking a few of the cliches out here and there, adding in a couple of, you know, maybe slightly more subversive things than normally are in Christmas songs, and just... I kind of went about it that way, really.
It must have been odd doing it in the summer. I remember always going past Jamie Oliver's house in Primrose Hill when the Christmas tree and the decorations were going in August, you know.
Exactly.
And his kids would be sweating in their jumpers outside. Did it feel a bit weird? Was your family going, hey, what's going on up there, Dad? It's Christmas. You know?
Well, it was such a weird time anyway, wasn't it? Because, you know, bear in mind, my kids were doing homeschool, of course. They were 7 and 9 at the time. So me and my wife were helping them with the homeschool stuff in the morning. And then we'd try and get a bit of work done in the afternoon while they kind of played and were outside. And it was so warm. April and May was so warm. And so I was literally sitting, I had the door open. I didn't even come up here to the studio. I was in the house. I've got an upright piano in the house right by the front door. Door was open, dogs and children running in and out. I had flip-flops on, shorts, and I was writing songs about snow, turning on lights, Santa Claus, and all that kind of stuff. And somehow the incongruity of the whole, of the weirdness of the universe that was happening at that time, it just happened. It was quite magical, actually. And in some ways, I feel like that all benefited it. And again, I've never written 10 songs so fully formed so quickly. None of them were sketches. They were written, although they weren't, the arrangements weren't written, the songs are written exactly as you hear, all just at the piano. I've got voice notes of every single one in their kind of entirety. Yeah.
Wow. Brilliant. But does that also, the problem you've got now is that your kids now expect 2 Christmases every year, one in the summer.
It's like the Queen's birthday, isn't it? Yeah.
Every day is Christmas when you're a child of that age, I reckon.
And then let's just talk about you going into Abbey Road 2 to record, because Abbey Road 2 is famously the Beatles studio, and we're all buzzing about the Beatles at the moment because of Get Back being on. Have you seen it yet?
Yeah, it's magnificent, isn't it, for us fans? And well, yeah. I mean, of course, everyone's a fan, aren't they? But no, it's a great bit of film, isn't it? It's incredible.
It's just a fantastic realignment, isn't it, to see that this beautiful positive thing, and just to, you know, and to hear them saying stuff you've read about for years and years and years. That's, you know,
it really humanizes them in a lot of ways. And again, at the time of their lives they were in as well. I'm sure, obviously, you know, you guys have, every time I meet Paul McCartney, I can't believe how nice and normal he is.
Yeah.
I can't believe
it. I see Alexis Petridis gave it a really bad review in The Guardian. He said, oh, it's so long, it's so boring, who wants to watch? But, you know, we've been sort of brought up on Big Brother and reality television. We're quite happy just to stare at people gossiping, aren't we?
No, I've seen quite a few people, like on Facebook and stuff, quite a few. It's like the cool thing is to knock the first one. I could have taken 9 hours of just that first one. The more, you know.
But let me just. I know we're here to talk to Jamie about Jamie.
I know.
But
sorry, we keep going off. Sorry.
I just want to say a
little bit about my theory on George, because, you know, George walks out, right? Now, we've always been told it's because Paul was a beast and he was mean to him. But George talks quite a lot early on about Eric and his guitar playing. And Eric is this new godlike guitarist, along with Jimmy, along with Pete, along with the other Jimmy. And suddenly George is feeling rather insecure, I think, about he's not that guy.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he's got Eric back at his house with his wife, right? So I think the cameras are on him. Yoko's eyes are on him. He walks out. He's just feeling not good about himself. But I don't think it's Paul's
fault. It's a very high-pressure situation, isn't it? And you're right, actually. There's surely some insecurity there. And that makes a lot of sense, actually. That makes a lot of sense.
Also, there's the other thing. One thing I certainly learned from this is that George was by far... he was really not the only lead guitarist in the Beatles. John had amazing chops. I'm never aware of.
Yes, that's true. You're right. Yeah. I hadn't really realised that before this as well. You're quite right.
But
and
Paul
they all
just
had such good sounds, didn't they? The sound. I know. We talk
that
about
that violin bass is a bit crap. It's I'm sorry.
Oh, but hang on, because on it there's and I
it's
said,
like sounds great when it's McCartney, but it's and you go, oh my god, it's McCartney and it's what he's playing. But if so, as a bass player, if anyone else picked up a bass and it sounded like that, it would just be like, mate.
Do you know? It's so funny. I've got one here in the studio because I want it to sound like that, and it just doesn't. It literally doesn't. I've actually had it remade.
You've literally got to be Paul McCartney
as a four-string tenor guitar. I've had it remade actually. It's a restrung, which is the way I play it. But no, I can't. I mean, who can play like Paul anyway?
But so, Guy, I took a screenshot and I sent it to you of the set list that's on top of the Hofner bass because you told me you.
I played it, but it was I was because my tech. A guy used to look after me with Pink Floyd, is Paul McCartney's tech, Sid Price. And I was at a McCartney show, and he said, come down. And he invited me down to the little cubbyhole at the side of the stage. He went, quick, here. And he handed me the violin bass, right, with the Candlestick Park set list on it. I was like, oh, fuck. And I've got it. But, of course, it's strung left-handed. So I was holding it upside down. So I managed to work out an upside-down day tripper. And then...
Jamie, what was it like going into Studio 2? There's a great sense of responsibility when you walk into that room, isn't there?
There is, and you know, I'm sure you can both attest to this as well. I think there is, like, when you go into any great studio like that, with, you know, Capitol in Los Angeles or you know, any of the really great studios. And I think for the first time walking into Studio 2 this time to record something, you know, all this music, we knew we had a job to do. We had really 2 days we had 1 day with the big band, really, to record all that music. And we went in there with a job to do. And I think with going into Abbey Road Studio 2, it does come with all the iconography and the history, but it's also a great studio. And you know you can get everything done there you need to do. So it was also the right tool for the job, if you know what I mean. So yes, it is this place that you can feel like it's a bit of a museum and just comes with everything. But there are certain studios where you can go in and record this amount of quite difficult, large music and it will be done. So I went in there with that feeling, knowing we had a job to do, but also like just how lucky. It felt like I'd given myself the best Christmas present ever. All these amazing musicians. You know, we'd been in lockdown and this was the first bit where it had been eased up. And I'm like... inadvertently I've written an album where I need the most musicians I've ever needed on one record. I don't think that was by accident.
Wow.
But there's also, I mean, because one thing that even we as bad don't know is the experience is the sound of a big band in a room is just the most joyous one. It's like there's nothing else that sounds like it.
No. Yeah, I totally agree. I think obviously with an orchestra with violins and woodwinds and something, that's like a warm bath. I think the big band is, I'm trying to think of an analogy of the big band.
Yeah, you're right in the warm bath, and I know what you mean about, I don't know where we go from there.
Yeah, I know exactly. But it's that combination of all that kind of wind going through metal.
Yes, the brass. It's just the brass. You know, it's just this impossible. It's impossible to be sad.
Talking about talking about Christmassy things and what they mean to. It's I remember seeing the Glenn Miller story as a kid and really loving that film. The sound of that big band in there. Mm. And they always used to seem to always had it on at Christmas because someone died in it and you're meant to, you know.
Yeah.
Something sad, but. Did you sit down with that orchestra, with those players, and sing along and play along, or did you do that as a separate overdub? And how did you put the album together?
No, so we did the kind of central part of it for real. So we do a couple of run throughs. I would be in the room with everyone, and there was a piano kind of cordoned off in the corner. And then on some, I would sing in a booth next to where they were. And my friend Tom was conducting, who arranged the music. And then there was sometimes a piano player who's far more gifted than I am, a guy called Ross Stanley, playing the piano if I needed to be up in the control room. And then sometimes I came down to do it. So a lot of it was done together. But the nature of these kind of records, you do end up designing some of it afterwards. But the central nucleus of it all is always done live for me, because I feel that otherwise you've got nowhere to build on. So I would say you could have heard it immediately after we recorded it. And most people would hear it sounding almost the same.
Wow.
And that is the level of the musicianship that we were dealing with.
But what about vocally? Did you re-record some of the vocals as well? Or were you just
Some of them. So I'd probably say about half and half, but I'm pretty wedded to the original performance in that type of music as well. You know, obviously the Sinatras and the Nat King Coles and the Tony Bennett's and the idea of them doing the vocal afterwards. I mean, it's like Frank would have been out the door before they finished the song, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's because the integrity of that performance, and look, I've done it a million different ways, and there's totally a reason to stay and craft a vocal and do it and, you know, comp it and make it into something that is designed to the song that you don't get in the moment. But with this type of music, I think grabbing a performance with the band creates a sense of liveliness, and I think is what gives this its liveliness over other big band orchestral albums. There are a lot out there, a lot of people do them, and sometimes I wonder why they feel so a bit tame to my ears. And that's not saying that, but you know, I love the original recordings, and I think that's because they were in a room. There weren't loads of screens between everyone. They were in a room. They kind of mixed it by where they were standing in the room half the time, you know.
And
sometimes I think that adds to the electricity.
That's the thing. I would say that's because I've got one of my favorite things. I got it for Christmas. I got it for Christmas when I was 26 from my mum, and it's the Capitol, it's Sinatra, the Capitol Years box set, all vinyl.
Yeah.
And the sound of those, because the funny thing is, because you'd still use the same mics. Mics haven't got better since then.
Yeah.
You know, you still want those mics. And it's almost like when with the advent post rock and roll, it's almost like we forgot how to record and had to learn all over again, because those records still sound, you know. I mean, your record, sort of the idea is to sound as good as one of those.
Exactly. You know, and that's where you kind of put your flag in the sand and you try, and obviously you fail, but at the same time, those guys knew, and actually the guys that we chose to, the guys and girls that we chose to play on this album, they know how to play for that music to sound that way. And it's a combination of how you voiced the chords, how you play towards the microphone, where the bell of the horn is, the volume, blending with the other instruments, where you sit in the room, where the drummer sits in the room. If you'd looked at the way we'd recorded it, it didn't look like most orchestral settings, because we were basing it off the way we've seen Count Basie record and the way we've seen Duke Ellington record, because they're the kind of nerds we are.
But the red light is on you.
I can talk to about it.
But the red light is on you, isn't it? Because you've got to deliver the vocal, and these, you know, you want it to be a one take. I have to say, the vocals on the album are fantastic. I mean, some of those notes you reach towards the ends of some of those big songs are phenomenal.
Well, that's really, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And it's I think obviously because I'd written them. And because I wasn't singing standards, it's not like I was thinking, oh, Tony Bennett does this here, or Frank does this here, or Nat King Cole does this here, or Ray Charles, or whatever. I was like, well, these are brand new. And I think I was living inside those songs. And I felt, as we were making this record, it just felt special. It felt, I'm sure you can attain to this as well. Sometimes when you're recording things, you don't know what it's going to be. While we were doing this one, we were all like, this is going to be a thing. This people are going to like this, and this is going to be around a while, you know. And whether that is all true or not, I don't know. But there was a really good feeling in the room, and it could have been post COVID. I don't know, but we felt really good while we were doing it.
It's funny how our Christmas, our sense of Christmas, is a mixture of Victorian horror and drama, mixed with
war films,
mixed with Jewish American guys writing the American Songbook Christmas for us. You know?
Exactly. I know you're entirely right, and actually, I think that's what's so brilliant about Christmas music, particularly "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas." You know, when you read the original lyrics, they're incredibly sad. Even Frosty the Snowman, if you go back to the original lyrics, it's all about Frosty dying, you know, and how we're all on planet Earth for such a short amount of time. We're basically all melting away, you know.
Wow.
So have fun in the sun while you're still around. I think there's a lot of that melancholy tucked into these Christmas songs, which is definitely something I wanted to reference as well. You know, that sense of time passing, and, you know, there being an empty seat at the table one year, and it's like, oh, goodbye, old Granny Sue, and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's very present. And I think last Christmas, this Christmas, that's going to be even more present for families. Of course it is. You know, most people I know have lost someone in the last 2 years.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs.
Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
What about Christmas? We were talking earlier. I was talking to Guy earlier before you came on about what music you got Christmas. Yeah. What was your... Did you used to get any gifts at Christmas? Was there any music that reminds you the most?
It was a very musical household you were in, wasn't it?
Was a musical household, but you know, I've got to give credit to my uncle, my mum's brother, who would come over. He's lived all over, but he lived in Germany and Sweden. He would come over at Christmas, and he would kind of deliver some deep, weird jazz record for my kind of collection, from Herbie Hancock to Pat Metheny to Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and stuff like this. Stuff that, and my mum and dad did love jazz, but he had a kind of next level kind of knowledge about it, and he could play a little bit as well.
Is that when you were really young?
Yeah, so 10, 11, 12,
I would
say.
That is challenging for that age. That's okay. So
jazz was coming into your life.
It was coming into my life, because my mum sung a bit. My mum and my uncle would sing and play together, you know, after a couple of drinks as well. And my mum always loved Billie Holiday, and she'd sing a couple of Billie Holiday things. And my uncle could play things on the guitar. I was learning rock guitar at the time, you know, really just playing like blues and AC/DC. And my brother and I would do like Iron Maiden guitar offs and stuff like that. And he would come and he would play these incredibly refined chords, you know, really just kind of major sevenths and, you know, just adding a couple of extensions. I'd be like, oh my God, what's that? You know? And as soon as someone plays a chord to you, if you've got an ear for it that sounds richer than anything you've heard, I was just like, can you show my tiny fingers getting around my little mini guitar, trying to kind of play a couple of these chords. And I think that was my kind of way in, just wanting to play those extra rich chords on the guitar.
The major ninths and the major sets.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff, yeah.
That's something I really want to get into, because you know, you're a very fine jazz musician, but you come from that sort of... I know you have piano lessons, but you never learned to read, right?
Yeah.
And so you come from that, basically, the sort of the same school as all us pop musicians. You know, you went to the Royal Academy of Bedroom.
Yes, exactly. and then
we all stopped and you kept going.
Yeah. some of us get stuck in the bedroom doing other things for far too long.
I'm sure there was a bit of that as well, but I think I was enthralled to kind of musicianship, and I think I'd started getting gigs so young that I saw the kind of payoff from a bit of practice and learning songs. And then some older musicians took me under their wing, and so I was playing harder stuff than I probably was able to from a young age. And I kind of never stopped until this year, when I started having lessons finally this year.
No.
I've been taking lessons all year. Yeah.
Stop now. You're going to break what was good.
Nah, not at all. It's so fun. It's so fun. I'm also not doing it for my own, but I'm just doing it for fun. It's so interesting.
Are you doing classical?
I'm doing harmony and jazz theory and just like learning how to refine a few things at the piano. It's really, I had the time this year, you know, again, no touring, and didn't really feel like jumping in to write another entire record just yet. I have been doing a little bit of writing, but I saw my kids learning on Zoom last year and I thought, well, why can't I do that as well? So I called up a professor of music at the Academy, and he's been teaching me on Zoom once every 2 weeks.
You know, I was reading a book on, I swear to God, last week, I was reading a book on guitar scale theory in bed. Yep. But I was like, what are you doing that for? You know how to play the guitar, but it's you know.
It's so funny. I've been doing exactly the same thing as well. I think when we're obsessed, aren't we?
I've been doing exactly the opposite, and I literally thought, right, lockdown, absolutely, and I did. I was doing these YouTube videos where I was revisiting all these sort of records I played on before, and I thought, well, actually, this is the time to learn all the stuff you didn't back then. And I signed up for an online sight reading course and all that stuff. None of it happened.
Well, yeah, he hasn't got the patience, mate.
I'm going to finally learn Teen Town.
Nah. It's got to be at the right. It's got to be at the right time, hasn't it? And I think that wasn't the right time. Somehow it was the right time for me. And I think it's just I'm a weird obsessive character that most musicians I know are. You know,
Jamie, when you were this kid who was deeply interested in jazz and being a musician and playing, was that a reaction? Was there? How do other? What I'm basically saying is, how do you have any mates when you're like that?
This is what's interesting, because apparently it was parallel, wasn't it, to being into very, you know, a lot of cooler music, was it, drum and
yeah,
bass
no,
and stuff.
It's exactly. I think it started off basically. I was mostly into the music my peers were into, and I was one of the kids that could play Nirvana's Nevermind album from top to bottom at a school campfire or whatever. I could play, you know, I could learn things on the guitar quite quickly, not particularly well, but I could play. And that was a great way of, like, I mean, it was my crutch. You know, we all have a teenage crutch, don't we? It's like you're the sports guy, you're the something guy, you're the tall one, or you're the good looking one. You know, I was the one who looked about 9 years old, but I could play the guitar.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you hated then, but I bet you're loving it now.
It's definitely not too bad now, but I know it's going to change. My friend said to me the other day when I turned up to dinner and someone said, oh, you look so young. And she said, go on. She said, admit it. If someone doesn't say that to you when you walk in a room, you're disappointed, aren't you? And I said, no, that's not true at all. I looked so young for so long. But it is what it is, isn't it? That whole thing. But playing the guitar was definitely my way of getting over a bit of teenage, of needing, you know, a bit of teenage power in some way. And so, yeah, I was playing all the music of the day. I was in little hip hop bands and rock bands, and I was just in all those kind of things. So it was all, as you say, it was all parallel. My musical interests were all parallel.
So when you're putting this first album together, what made you think I can sell records doing jazz? You're doing the American Songbook. Because was that not on your mind, this idea of succeeding in a genre that, you know, it wasn't really happening?
Yeah, I can safely say that it wasn't on my mind, and I think that was possibly part of the secret, because, you know, I was born in Essex. I grew up in rural Wiltshire. My dad got a job in Swindon. My parents were both first generation immigrants. You know, my life had no connection to the media or music world in any, not even close, you know. I was in school plays and stuff, but I wasn't the kid in front of the mirror with a hairbrush as a microphone. I was enthralled to music, and I loved music, but I didn't really think I would be a musician for a living. I went to uni, I did English, I did film. I wanted to do something creative, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And music always seemed like it would be this thing I would do. And I would always do. But so when I made my first album, it was to sell at wedding gigs. I was doing wedding gigs, and people would always ask me if I had a tape or a CD. And I thought, well, I could make an extra 10, 20 quid here each gig. And so I made this CD with the band I had at the time of just standards, called it Heard It All Before. And I got my friend, my really good, she's still a good friend of mine called Kate.
Where'd you get the money?
Student loan. Wow. I use my student loan.
We had Arthur Baker on the other day. He got his, did his first album based on his bar mitzvah money, didn't he? Which, yes, I loved.
I'm intrigued by your band. Are these kind of like jazzers? These guys are a lot older than you.
Well, back in those days, I was playing a mixture. So a lot of the people that took me under their wing were in their 60s and 70s who didn't read music at all, but really knew jazz, and they would show me stuff. So I was playing all around Swindon, all the little villages around Swindon, and different pubs at these old man jazz pubs. And, they were so excited. There was this young guy that was into this music, could play a little bit of it, and I could also sing, you know. So I did a lot of that. But my band now is people I've been playing with a long time who are all a similar age or younger to me. And the truth is, the jazz industry these days, the musicians, they're all getting younger and younger. And they're so 19, 20 year olds. All the information is out there. They are so unbelievably gifted. It's like I'm a minnow.
You see them on Instagram, don't you? They're all going to Berkeley and stuff, and they're just phenomenal players.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and you can't. You know, it's to be celebrated rather than you know, being feeling insecure about, because it's you know, jazz. Everyone knows that obviously jazz, you need some kind of technique, but you know, there's nobody wants to hear a song like this jazz technique. Not even the great jazz musicians. And you know, you just have to hear two bars of Miles and you know that, you know.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the thing to remember is the more great musicians there are, it's like you need people who are going to pull them together, not necessarily just have great musicians around, you know.
So exactly.
But I think you're missing something out here, Jamie, because obviously you're talking about chords and beautiful chords and your piano playing, etc. But what really stood you out from the crowd was your voice. And
which is way belies your years,
you know, and
really early on.
Well, I think what it is a sense of expression that you have, and I think there's the actor in you. You could have been a great actor, right? Because you're a good impersonator, but you're also really good at capturing emotion, and that all comes through in your voice at such a young age. I mean, what, you're 19 when you're making your first record or something? I don't know.
That's really I've not heard anyone put it like that before, and I think I was possibly, we get a bit psychological for a second. I think I was probably expressing quite a lot of generational stuff that was kind of coming through from my grandparents, who my grandmother was.
That's quite a story, isn't it?
She was a Jewish. She was from Prussia. It's now part of Poland. She was Jewish and escaped the Nazis and ended up in Jerusalem, where my dad was born. My mum was born in Burma. Her father was Indian and Burmese, and they all kind of came over here, you know, for different reasons, but with nothing, and kind of started off with nothing. And there was a lot of kind of unacknowledged, you know, storytelling and pain and all that kind of stuff.
That's in the culture as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I think maybe there was quite a lot of there in me that I didn't know about. But I think also, mimicry is a huge thing in any artist's path, I think, and I've come to appreciate that more and more. And really, I saw Harry Connick Jr. on like the equivalent of Lorraine while I was getting ready for school one morning. My mom just had it on, and I was like, who's that guy playing the piano? You know, this had this New Orleans accent. He was kind of dressed in a suit, not like the normal music I would listen to, but I thought he just seemed cool. And he wasn't doing the When Harry Met Sally stuff. He was doing that Professor Longhair, Dr. John kind of piano stuff, and singing and really kicking the piano sustain pedal with the heel of his foot and slapping on the piano and singing a bit like Sinatra and then a bit like Dr. John, but playing a bit like Thelonious Monk and the blues people and the jazz people. It kind of blew my mind, and I got into him and then into lots of other jazz people through him. And I think those early recordings, I probably was just trying to copy him, to be honest. And then I found my own voice through trying to copy people like him.
Well, I'm also wondering, because it's interesting that Gary mentions the acting thing, because you were studying film.
I was studying film.
I wonder if that informed that in any way. That's sort of because you're seeing visual, like proper real life storytelling.
I always used to find acting a bit awkward when I did it at school. And I would see people who I think really inhabited what they were doing. And there would be an internal voice in my head going, you can't do this. This isn't real. You're not very good at this. And the opposite happens when I'm doing music. I don't have an internal voice when I'm playing music. I mean, sometimes I do, but mostly I feel like I don't have to think too much when I'm playing. I think I can really stay present in the moment when I'm playing. And I never found that when I did the little bit of acting that I've done. But I think it's that being drawn towards creative arts in general was something that I couldn't I couldn't escape, and whether it was film or music or anything.
I think this idea of mimicry that you mentioned, this is something interesting in that, because it's a great form of defense as well, because you can say things, be things that you're not, or you can reveal yourself through another identity. So you sit at the piano, you've got this American accent, like most of us have when we sing, you know, you're somebody else. So it makes you braver to reveal your emotions and to challenge those idiots out there that we all have in our life, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a really elegant point. And I think it would take a musician to point that out, and it would take another singer to point that out, because you do, you know, I certainly found like I was a very agreeable, meek child, really, in retrospect. I was very well behaved, and almost to a fault to some degree. And it was through music that I discovered the every bad boy impulse that I'd never kind of explored. And music was the conduit to all of that. And it was great, because we all need a bit of light and shadow, don't we? And, you know, music was absolutely my route into that, and my route into exploring things that were a lot harder, that weren't talked about in my family for obvious reasons. And I think, you know, it's how music's functioned for generations, for cultures and people, and in my own way. And I know it doesn't sound like that, kind of growing up in a village just outside of Swindon, but actually there was a lot of complicated stuff that had come before me that was suddenly in that house for many generations. And, you know, a lot of that comes out through music, I think.
What was the turning point then for you from going from this kid selling wedding albums? Guy was saying to me earlier that when we were having a chat before.
Michael Parkinson champion. You got into the Pizza Express circuit, didn't you?
Yeah, so I started doing the Pizza Express circuit. Basically, after a while, I realised I hadn't noticed anyone else who was a young man singing these types of songs. And bear in mind, this entire time I was in every other type of band you can imagine, from a, you know, heavy metal bands to hip hop bands. I was playing.
Did any of those
band.
People go anywhere? Did any of those other bands go anywhere? Is there anything where you could have been? I could have been in Muse. I don't know.
I was in a band that there's a really talented singer songwriter who still releases his own music called Alexander Wolf. I was in his band for a while. That was the one that could have gone somewhere. So he's fantastic. He writes a lot for theatre now as well. But you should check him out if you haven't heard him. He's really, really good. But at that point, I think I just noticed that I was getting a lot of gigs, more gigs than I could do. Every night of the week I could have been playing when I was at uni by the third year. And I think by that time I was like, look, I told my mum and dad, I'm going to finish uni and then I'm just going to play music for a couple of years. I'm going to try and travel and play music and see where I go with it. And at that stage I thought, well, if I could end up playing someone like Ronnie Scott's, that would, in 20 years time, that would be the, you know, that would be the kind of goal. And, you know, maybe I could get a small record deal or something. So I was starting to, by the end of university, I was thinking, well, let's give it a whirl. I went to work on a cruise ship for 3 weeks. I missed my graduation. I played on a cruise ship and I'm playing in other bands.
What was that like?
It was so fun. I had a brilliant time. And absolutely, we did Greek islands. We did the Norwegian fjords, and we did the coast of somewhere in the coast of Europe. It was really fun. You know, I was 20 years old, 21 years old, you know what it's like when you're playing music at that age. And it was just, it was wild. It was super wild.
Play music with free food.
Exactly. It was amazing. But it was after that. I just had gigs all the time, including at Pizza Express, where I got free pizzas with my wage. And just gradually, just the momentum started to pick up. And I ended up getting a small deal with the label Candid Records. And that is where Michael first heard me, played me on his radio show. And then Sony and Universal started sniffing around. And it was at that point, I just signed a record deal with Universal. And I was on the Michael Parkinson TV show, which happened to be the one where he fell out with Meg Ryan.
No, I don't remember that.
He had kind of fight with Meg Ryan on the show. And it was watched by like 18 million, you know what TV shows used to be like.
So you're thinking, oh, my little piano playing's vanished now, but actually, in actual fact, it ended up as a focal point.
Well, do you know what? I knew it was a huge moment.
Did you do a relevant song as well? You didn't do like kind of breaking up his heart.
Did you start playing the Benny Hill theme as they were chasing each other around the studio?
I should point out that I wasn't the house band like Laurie Holloway was, but I played a song called You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You, and I remember feeling kind of terrified before, and I was wearing a bad suit and I had a bad haircut, as you know, all the usual stuff. But I remember as soon as I was playing, I'd had thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of hours in piano bars, pubs where people weren't listening, all this. So as soon as I was playing, I was like, okay, I know how to do this bit. And it was watched by, you know, and before I knew it, my record was starting, and then I released an album on Universal called 20 something. And that obviously became quite a big deal when it came out.
Yeah, you could say that.
And you got a massive record deal, which is quite something at the time, I remember. Yeah,
it was a bit more of a press story than the actual record deal. It was basically, I had enough to pay off my student loan and enough to pay off my rent for the next
Jesus,
few
how
months.
Are you living as a student? And,
exactly.
Bullingdon Club kind
the
of
million thing. Pounds was for the marketing spend. Right, so it's, right, so it's right, quite right. quite amazing that everyone said, "Oh, you got £1 million." Like, no, I didn't. I got about 25 grand, which was a huge amount, obviously, for a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, a huge amount. And then I got a publishing deal after that as well. So I was all right after that, but it was, I remember people, my mates, thinking that I was suddenly a millionaire, and I was like, not quite, but I'm doing all right.
It's pretty awkward, isn't it, to have something like that out in the public domain?
Yeah, for sure.
How did you bring your own songwriting into this mix? Because obviously, you know, that you're by osmosis, you've taken in the American songbook. Did you find that part of that mimicry could also be used as a songwriter?
Yeah, fortunately, I'd started to include original songs on those earliest albums, just here and there. And it was always something that was there, but I didn't honestly feel like a songwriter for a long time. I felt like it was something that I would do by accident if I was lucky. And it wasn't until an album I made in 2009, where I did quite a lot more original songs. I felt like I wrote some things that were really kind of valuable.
Is that the one you did in LA, isn't it?
I did that one in LA, and I wrote this song.
That's
for
what
this
I interviewed you about.
There you go. Yeah, that's the one I did in LA, and I wrote this song for this Clint Eastwood film called Gran Torino, and I felt around that time that I'd really started to have a handle on. I was becoming maybe less a jazz musician and a kind of interpreter, and more of a, you know, I was moving towards concentrating more on songwriting.
Would that be through Kyle Eastwood?
Exactly. Yes, it was through Kyle. So.
Carl Eastwood is Clint Eastwood's son, who's a jazz bass player for our listeners.
You got a nomination for Golden Globe.
I mean, it was such a weird kind of turn of events. So I wrote it with Kyle, and obviously Clint was one of the co-writers on that song, which was.
So what? But did you meet him? Was he in the room? What was the vibe?
Yeah. So I'd known Kyle for a bit. Most jazz musicians in London know Kyle because he's a great bass player.
I meant Clint.
Yeah. Well, and so I met Clint at the Monterey Jazz Festival, which is the one out where he used to be the mayor of Carmel, didn't he? So it's where that scene from Play Misty for me is that very festival.
Fantastic.
So, and he was sitting in the audience. So I met him there, and then I worked on something through Kyle and his producer friend, Michael Stevens, on a film called Grace Is Gone, which he did. Clint also worked on the music for as well, although he didn't direct it. And then it was after that went really well. And then Clint and Kyle came to me with this theme for Gran Torino, this opening theme, and I kind of completed part of the writing with them and then wrote all the lyrics for it and then kind of made it into a, you know, composed it into a song, basically.
Did Clint Eastwood whistle a tune to you at any point?
He did. he did, but he also sat at the piano and played that theme and did a little whistle.
Did it have a sort of Ennio Morricone vibrato?
I know, exactly. I mean, all those things are going through my mind, believe me. Given that I'm like steeped in jazz history, but also in film history as well, you know, these are my obsessions. It all came together at the same time, and it didn't feel real, but it did. It was a situation where I think 10 years before that, I might have stacked it. I might have not been able to kind of rise to the challenge, but I think at that point, I felt like I was becoming a writer above and beyond kind of everything else that I was striving to do.
What was the song for you, Jamie, where you went, this is it now, I know how to do this. I have not had anyone else in the room. This has come completely from me. What was that?
I think it was this tune I wrote for my last album called The Age of Anxiety.
Oh, yeah, which is a very strong, I was going to say bold, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's certainly to delves.
Well, they're all words I really appreciate connected to the song, because it's definitely, I feel like it says something I feel like if a song can say something in a way that not the words on their own and not the music on their own can, so kind of in their togetherness, they make something that is greater than the constituent parts, then And also, it wasn't a laboured writing. It was. It's not that it took me a long time, but it came out of me in a kind of authentic way, and kind of now exists as something that almost feels like, and exists as something as almost I feel like I didn't write. It's kind of there now. And whilst I would love to kind of recapture that, I think sometimes those songs kind of come round, and you know, it's not a hit by any stretch of the imagination, and I never expected it to be, but it's definitely a song that I feel is the best kind of expression of my songwriting so far, really.
That's amazing that it's come so late in your career, that sense that you're still on this learning curve and it's still going up, you know.
Well, I mean, I think also it's the nature of being like a jazz musician at my heart, because I think jazz musicians and songwriting, they don't always go together quite well, because you focus for quite a long time on technique and this kind of jazzness of things, which is a whole other kind of, it's like training for a different Olympic sport. And writing, you know, my whole world of writing is through the amount of reading that I do, the amount of lyric writing that I love, and poems, and you know, reading novels and making notes on novels and stuff. It's almost like another thing, and it just took me a while to have the confidence to bring those things together in a way that you see someone like Alex Turner doing at 17.
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't that kid at 17. I was a geeky muso kid playing, like, dreaming about being a session musician, you know. Alex Turner was dreaming about being a rock star and writing lyrics for Arctic Monkeys that were so sophisticated. Mm. I just wasn't, that was not who I was at that point. I was, you know, I may never be that, but at the same time, I feel like I'm accessing more of that part of myself now.
But the irony,
at 21.
Right, the irony is that your voice was very much that of a fully formed grown-up person when you were very young.
Yeah, to some degree, I can see what you mean.
But also,
yeah,
I think it's something else. Say, Alex. All right, you mentioned Alex, and there he is in the Arctic Monkeys. He's surrounded himself by a band, right? So you feel a lot more security in a band. I think you can sort of, anything goes wrong, you go, it was him, he did it. You know, it's his fault.
Yeah, me
you're
usually.
You're out there on your own. You know, I actually think that's. Is there ever a time when you do feel lonely about this, that all the weight is on your shoulders? You can't but share any of those bad reviews with other people, if you get any. Yeah. Of course you don't.
I know what you mean, and I feel very close to my band. You know, they're my best friends as well. You know, they're amazing people, and we're like another family.
Yeah, give it time.
But yeah. But I do feel you're right. It is like you don't, the successes are great to take and like, oh yeah, it's amazing. And you know, but the when things don't work, yeah, you're alone with that. But at the end of the day, it's still better than most other jobs you can do, isn't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's two sides to that, which is yes, you have to take all the flack, but then you get all the praise.
Yes, but that's true. You do get all the praise. Like I did that, you know, with the Age of Anxiety. It's literally like I literally sat at the piano for a few months and kind of wrote that song. And it's like, there's literally no one else involved. I mean, I would definitely credit my wife with encouraging me to kind of delve deeper and be a bit more exploratory of myself and my music as well. So. So she was definitely a big part of it.
And
that
are you
well.
Taking this out? Well, I mean, you can't take it out on the road. You can't sort of be playing the Christmas album for the day, for into the summer. So what's the plan?
Well, I've got some Downing Street parties. Exactly. Apparently, the noise level is going to be so small that I won't be able to play it properly. I've got a couple of in-stores. We're doing a couple of things on like Chris Evans and Joe Wiley and stuff like that. But I'm hoping to next year do like a week's residency somewhere where we play all this music and just kind of plan it way in advance and just sit in one place in maybe two or three cities for 3 or 4 or 5 days and do this music, because it's you know, assembling that band and playing this music
That'd
for
the great.
Piano Man at Christmas is going to be so fun.
And the great plan, obviously, is that we hope that some of these become Christmas standards.
You know, I think there is that hope. I think many, many people making Christmas albums now are hoping for exactly the same thing. And I think for me, what I've been aware of so far is the amount of people that, you know, email me or tell me on social media that, oh my God, we had your album on while we were putting up our Christmas tree. We had your album on Christmas Day, and my granddad loves it. My son loves it. And it's like, I feel like it has infiltrated some people's homes. And actually, it's ended up being a probably more successful album than I've had for years. And I wouldn't have anticipated that at all.
It's when the songs turn up on Michael Bublé's album.
Yeah.
That's yeah. not true. Well, actually, he very kindly got in touch with me to say how much he loved the album. So I thought that's a fairly decent stamp of approval. That's for sure.
And are you working on new material now?
I am. That would be my focus for next year. I don't know whether I'll have anything ready for next year, but I'm looking ahead. I've got lots of the gigs that were in last year in next year, kind of peppered throughout the year. And I just want to write another kind of 10-track album inspired by the Piano Man at Christmas, although not a Christmas album, just really try and sit at the piano and write 10 fully formed things and then try and make something beautiful that has a little bit of this classic edge as well, actually. I think I'm going to try and do that.
Yeah, because your albums do also, it's almost like you sit down and each album has a very conscious direction to it.
Yeah.
It's like, right, this album is going to be this and this, you know, because you drifted into very much the, you know, because you started with this real USP of being the jazz guy. And then with this mainstream pop success, you kind of drifted, your writing became very much more informed by the sort of singer-songwriter style of writing. And that's why I was really pleased that I love that you've gone back to writing full-on jazz stuff. It's like, don't lose that. Yeah. Don't lose that.
So, no, definitely. I think I'll always do a mixture of the two because it's just fun to write in different ways. But I feel quite inspired by this kind of bringing this element, you know, maybe, you know, still keep the kind of pop-ish aspect, but then really bring this nicely composed kind of stuff that I've done on this this Christmas album into some of my original non-Christmas music, non-denominational.
My non-Christmas music.
Do you think...
Do you do non-Christmas music?
Excuse me, Guy, I'm trying to get the last question in, if I may.
Sorry.
Do you think, because I know we're going to let Jamie go, but do you think... writing on your own now is the only way forward, because I know in the past you've written with people like Ricky Ross and
I love to write with other people.
Okay, so I'll be around to your house very soon.
I absolutely love it, and I think it's I love writing on my own, but I think you get different stuff working with other people, and you never know what you're going to get, whether it's a song for you, a song for another artist, or you just learn something new. And I think I tried to go into co-writes with a sense, you know, you go in with expectation, you want to write something, but at the same time, you never know what relationships and what music it's going to yield. So no, I'm not a closed book in that sense at all. I don't care if someone else's name is on it. It doesn't have to feel like it's entirely mine, because I just don't think life and music works like that, and neither should it.
It's been great having you on, Jamie.
Really, it's a
thrill, guys. Thank you so much. I'm honoured to be on your podcast. Thank you so much. Absolutely honoured. Thank you.
and good luck.
I hope to see you out there.
Good luck with this album. It's really worth. Everyone should just download it. Make it your Christmas this year.
Yeah, because it is. It's a genuinely proper, good, you know, and new Christmas album. And so, actually, Jamie, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Do you know what I'm off to do now?
Go on.
I'm off to record the Strictly Come Dancing Christmas special.
Oh,
can you believe that?
Oh,
that is literally, I'm literally going to walk out this door and I'm going to go and head off to Elstree to do that. So
have a lovely time.
More Christmassy.
Brilliant.
Have a great Christmas. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much, both. Great to meet. Great to see you on like this. Yeah. See you later. Yeah,
bye.
Cheers, Jamie.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Well, that was delightful.
It was, wasn't it? What a nice bloke, you know, really.
What a nice man. I did worry that we were over Sondheiming a bit at the moment, at the beginning, but it was great. He went with it. He was very, very amazing.
Yeah. Okay, so I didn't tell you, did I, what albums I got for Christmas? I need to tell you that.
No, you didn't. No. Right. God, have you been waiting all through that interview? You were 80% talking to Jamie and 20% waiting to tell me what albums you got for Christmas. It was just there the whole time, wasn't it?
Well, it was actually
you weren't really present at all.
It was actually more like 30%, really. So my very first Christmas album was Electric Warrior, T-Rex, right? You must have had that, right? Oh, you're a bit... You know what? I'm a bit older than you, and I'm 2 years older than you.
No, I had... that period... No, I hate to say it. I'm ashamed of it now, but... I was at that age where you actually had to choose between Slade and T-Rex.
Well,
and I was Slade.
Well, I got so Electro Warrior was that Christmas, 71. 72, I got Slade. S-L-A-Y-E-D. The Slade album for Christmas.
I got Slade Alive.
I know you did. lots of times.
and Flayed.
And I tell you what, there are two more, and then I can't remember anymore
come
after
on,
that.
So on.
The following year, 73, 71, 72, yes, I got Tales from Topographic Oceans.
Oh, there you go. Oh, I got Tubular Bells.
Did you?
Yes.
That's so Christmassy, isn't it?
That's so Christmas. It wasn't then, but now it is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. But I tell you what's
Christmassy, it was The Exorcist.
Yeah, but it's got bells on it, you know. But I tell you what's not Christmassy is what I got the following year, 74, was Yes's Relayer. So yeah, I was obviously a bit of a Yes man for a while, but Mum actually went to the record shop and bought Relayer. Can you imagine what they thought? What kind of this woman walks in with pie and mash takeaway in one hand, asking for Relayer.
Yeah. Can I also just say, for the record, this is the only time I've ever heard you describe yourself as a Yes man. Because boy, are you not.
Right. Unfortunately, I'm going to see you before Christmas actually arrives. So I won't wish you a Merry Christmas.
You won't anyway.
I won't anyway.
That's outside. That's mean. Sorry.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more.
With with the Rock on Tours Hootenanny, I guess.
I guess it must be. Until then, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.